as a way to amplify their persuasive appeal to their public. What happens every time Vladimir Putin feels like he might be in trouble? He poses shirtless. He poses shirtless again. And he poses shirtless again. In fact, he inspires art of him posing shirtless. So when you think about these aspects, there is a reason for this. It's not irrational. Now, I do not think that Vladimir Putin is reading psychology literature and making his adjustments to his leadership style accordingly, but I do think he's tapped into this aspect of our psychology that is incredibly, incredibly stupid and yet does actually affect our decision making. Now, imagine any other context in which this would happen. Imagine that you have a dentist that's the leading dentist in Copenhagen, and you're about to get your wisdom teeth removed on the operating table, and they rip open their shirt and show their prowess. I mean, you would report them to the board immediately, right? You would get another dentist. And yet we have in politics this idea that this is like part of what it might mean to be a politician, these shows of machismo and sort of strength. And then we have another problem. I know there's a lot of problems, but there's another one. Psychopaths.
You're listening to Brian Kloss on The Wrong People at the Top. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And then we have another problem. I know there's a lot of problems, but there's another one. Psychopaths. Now, there may be a link to Vladimir Putin. I can't clinically diagnose him, but I will say that psychopaths are a real problem when it comes to positions of power. A psychopath is someone who might not look like a psychopath. One of the things that is a characteristic of psychopathy is that they're very, very good at blending in and looking like everybody else. And they have three traits in particular which form what's called the dark triad. The dark triad is composed of narcissism, so extreme egotism, Machiavellianism, where someone is a strategic thinker where the ends justifies the means for them, especially in getting power, and psychopathy, or being a psychopath. These are not good traits to exist in common, and unfortunately they correlate very often with each other. Now, if you think about why they're not good, in addition to the fact that you wouldn't want a psychopath in charge, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, think about what they end up doing. There's this drive for power. Remember the Abraham Vald story about the airplanes and the World War II survivorship bias. Psychopaths are obsessed with power over other people. Okay, that's seeking power. Machiavellians are very strategic thinkers who are good at getting what they want. That's getting power. And narcissists are so obsessed with their ego and how others perceive them that they actually can detect threats because they understand when they're getting unpopular with their colleagues. So that's maintaining power. It's the perfect cocktail. So you have this cocktail of psychological traits that is highly correlated with ending up in power, and unfortunately, not with wielding it well. Depending on the study that you look at, it's measured different ways, there's different scales and different checklists and so on for psychopathy. The number of people who are in power who are psychopaths is somewhere between 4 times and 25 times the general public. This is not good, right? This is a very, very bad thing for us, because even though they may be ruthlessly calculating individuals who sometimes can be logical thinkers, in those moments of crisis, when things are really on the line and change is happening rapidly, that's when empathy is most important. It's when you have to care about other people, and they don't have it. In fact, psychopaths are really fascinating in how they don't have empathy. They have something that's wrong with their brains in this section of the brain called the amygdala, regulates emotions. And there's various discussions about what causes psychopathy. There's a discussion where some people think it's you're born with it, some people think it's environmental factors, and some people think it's a combination of the two. But what is clear is that when you put psychopaths in MRI scanners and you look at their brains while you show them extremely disturbing videos, so in one study I'm thinking of, they show them videos of children and animals suffering in really horrific ways, the psychopaths' brains were blank. They didn't react, didn't bother them. When they scanned normal people, they lit up like a firework and they asked to get out of the MRI scanner, please. However, this is the crucial bit. There was a sort of little stroke of insight that one of the researchers had, and she said, what happens if I tell the psychopaths to imagine what it would be like to care about those people? Imagine that you have empathy. put them back in the scanner, rescan the brains, turn on the videos, normal. They look effectively normal. And what this means is that psychopaths can pass as normal people when they need to. However, some are not very good at this. And this is where you get a divide between the unsuccessful psychopaths and the successful psychopaths. The unsuccessful psychopaths are not disciplined. Where do they end up? Prison. They kill people, they abuse people, and they commit crimes. So there's a very high proportion of the incarcerated population for violent crimes, for example, that are psychopaths. And those are people who, when they needed to be disciplined, when they needed to pass like the rest of us, they couldn't. They couldn't turn it off. They couldn't upregulate the empathy that they needed to. The successful psychopaths, in a variety of different studies of what is called snakes in suits, they're in boardrooms and they're in politics. And they're people who understand how to turn on the empathy, to make shows of it when they need to act like normal people, and yet they don't. They don't actually feel it. And this is a huge problem. It's a huge problem because it links again to the system. What I talked about before, being on autopilot. When you talk to experts on psychopathy, as I have many, many around the world, what they always say, without fail, are these two words. Psychopaths yield superficial charm. Superficial charm means in a short period, not for years and years and years, but for a short period, they can make them very likable to you, right? They can make people like them. That's bad news for us because the way we've designed promotion and sort of election to power is effectively the job interview, 45-minute exercise, can you make someone like you in 45 minutes? Elections, you're never going to actually meet these people, most of them, but you have to get an impression of them that is superficially charming. We've designed systems that amplify these traits. They reward them because they don't have to show effective performance. They have to show likability. So we're systematically downgrading the appeal for a person who's an introvert, who has a really hard time speaking in public and so on. And we're amplifying traits that are not necessarily tied to servant leadership and public service and good leaders, but are just tied to superficial charm. So these are not areas where we can just sort of say, let's just do what we did before, right? We have to think much more carefully about how we design systems in this realm. And when it comes to psychopaths, you know, they're still a minority. It's very unlikely that your boss is a psychopath. Maybe some of you. But it is statistically unlikely still. The problem is that they do disproportionate damage, right? So when you think about psychopaths in power, one of the arguments that sometimes is made around them, and you'll see books, there's a book called The Wisdom of Psychopaths, for example, by Kevin Dutton. And what he argues is that we have to find a place for these people. Why not just put them in high-stress situations? Because one of the things that psychopaths have that the rest of us don't is they are very, very calm when an emergency is going on and when things normally would fluster the rest of us. A psychopath doesn't have their heart rate elevate, they don't get an emotional response, etc. So what Dutton argues, I think, persuasively, is around the idea of, for example, a bomb defusal expert in the military. I can see the argument here a little bit. But I think he goes a little bit too far when he talks about surgeons. It's true that a surgeon is under stress, under immense pressure, and may need to be a cold, calculating individual. But I put it to you this way. You go to the doctor, you go to the surgery for your operation, and they say, don't worry, you're in good hands. We've got a psychopath today. I mean, nobody's going to go. You're going to run out of that room, right? So the problem is that when it really counts, we don't think this way. And when it really counts, if we're not willing to have somebody with a scalpel operate on one person, why could we possibly tolerate entire societies being run often by psychopaths? And this is particularly problematic in worse systems, right? So I can't speak about, I'm not a clinical psychiatrist, I can't speak about Denmark psychopaths. What I can say is that when it comes to dictators, I would bet a lot of money that very, very many of them are psychopaths. And the reason why I would bet that is because another trait that they have, which makes them destructive in power, is they discount risk. They don't think risk applies to them because they're smarter than everybody else. That's what they think anyway, right? Now, this is a problem for dictators because dictators often die in office or they get jailed or they get forced into exile. Very few dictators have a cushy retirement. And what that means is that when you think about entering power in a dictatorial system, you know, some of the people that I've spoken to, former heads of state in Thailand and Madagascar and all around the world, those people have to think, well, that happened to my predecessor, but it would never happen to me. Now, that's a psychopath trait. And so when those people do inevitably get toppled and end up getting killed or jailed or exiled, they're surprised, but they've discounted risk. Now, in our societies, discounting risk might not be necessary to enter politics. It may be, but it's not as crucial as in an authoritarian regime. But when psychopaths are in those moments of crunch time, they think, I'll roll the dice. The problem is they're rolling the dice with our lives, with our economies, CEOs making bad decisions, getting into money laundering scandals. In addition to this, you have issues where, you know, these problems are things where you can put safeguards in them. Because what I've talked about so far is issues related to all sorts of areas of power. And they're multifaceted, right? The self-selection bias, who seeks power, the Machiavellians being better at getting power, the psychopaths overrepresented in power, power corrupting, the Ma'anan Sheilas of the world. So we've got a lot of problems. How are we going to fix it? Well, there's a lot of different ways we can tackle this problem, and I don't have unlimited time, but I am going to cover a few that I think are worth considering. One of them is exploiting the power of randomness. In fact, two of them exploit the power of randomness. And I'm going to tell you a story that's really interesting from the New York Police Department. I interviewed the former head of internal affairs at the NYPD, and he's a man who basically, his livelihood is about catching crooked cops, right? He's trying to expose people who are stealing or beating up people or using too much violence in the NYPD. And what he designed was an ingenious tactic that I think we should use much more widely. He designed what are called integrity tests. So what he would do is he'd rent an apartment in New York City, and this would be the fake crime scene. The fake crime scene would dispatch an officer, and they would say, look, we've just been tipped off. We think there's some money and some drugs in this place. There's nobody there. We need you to go and survey the scene and wait for backup to arrive. But nobody's been there yet. Now, when the officer would arrive, there would be, let's say, $20,000 on the table in cash. There'd also be a whole bunch of drugs with a high street value. What the officer didn't know is that the whole building was wired up with cameras and microphones. And what they were doing is they were trying to see, what does this officer do? Do they take the money? Do they just report it as $20,000 and the exact number of bags of drugs on the table and so on? Some of the time, the officers said, I found $14,000. And they took $6,000 home with them. Now, when that happened, these officers were arrested or fired. But here's the crucial bit. They only did about 500 integrity tests through this entire year that they started the pilot. They did a survey of officers in the NYPD, and they said, were you the subject of an integrity test this year? Did you go to a fake crime scene? 6,000 officers said yes. What that means is that 5,500, 12 times as many as the real number, thought they were at set-up crime scenes when they were at real ones. And everybody else in the NYPD thought they could be at a fake crime scene anytime they responded to a call. So with just 500 sting operations against these crooked cops, the entire force became better. Because all of them feared that it was a setup. It was a possibility, right? You didn't need to make every cop go through the test. You just need to make it so that every so often one would. And every so often they catch word of the cop being fired because they stole money. The rates of abuse plummeted. They even did some of these integrity tests, which, imagine this as your job. You would provoke an officer to try to hit you. So you would be posing as a sort of civilian, and you'd be insulting them, and you'd be trying to get them to hit you. And if they did, they'd be fired, right? Now, these integrity tests, again, very often the police officers would sometimes hit real civilians. But, of course, in these issues, that rate declined as well because they feared being exposed. The second area where the power of randomness is very helpful is with defeating the self-selection problem. This is an image of what's called the Clericarion, which is from ancient Athens. And it was effectively a way of developing a citizen assembly that was sort of like jury duty. They had various rows in the Clericarion. You'd put in your little trinket that was for you. And if they drew your row, you had to be someone who was governing society for that period of time. Random selection. Now, I don't think, this is called, by the way, in political science, we call this sortition. I don't think sortition is a good idea to replace politicians, and the reason I don't think it's a good idea to replace them is because there are actually things that a lifetime of being a politician does teach you. And some of those things are very technical, right? So if you have a nuclear test ban treaty, or you're dealing with a geopolitical crisis, it's actually good that some of the people who are making decisions know some of the background. However, I do think we should do random selection for oversight. And what I mean by this is that you randomly take the same number of people who are in your parliament, your Congress, as it were, and you give them the exact same questions. You give them exactly the same access to experts. And you say, what would you decide? Now, what you've taken out is you've taken out the money, you've taken out the power for its own sake, you've taken out the self-selection bias, you've taken out the lobbying, and you've taken out the re-election. Many of the things that warp our decisions. Now, even if these people couldn't actually choose for us, they couldn't change the taxes, they couldn't decide whether to send weapons to Ukraine or whatever it was of the day, what would be really fascinating is, imagine you're a journalist and you're interviewing a politician on one of the Sunday news programs. And you say, you know, it's really interesting that you've decided to award this contract to this group. Because when we asked the randomly assorted selection of citizens, they didn't do anything like that. They had a totally different answer. And now it's provided some oversight, a check, saying, look, you know, ordinary people answer this question very easily. They compromise. They come up with a solution. It's pragmatic. Why can't you? And that aspect would put pressure on the politicians, right? So between the random selection for oversight and this aspect, I think we can get a lot done in positions of power. And by the way, when it comes to integrity tests, I know this is a slightly zany idea, but I believe it would work. I think we should do sting operations for politicians. If it's good enough for cops, why isn't it good enough for politics? Try to get the best lobbyists. Try to get a crooked deal through. Have a journalist organize a fake company. In the UK, where I live, there was a huge amount of waste of money around the pandemic because conservative members of the government were giving contracts to their friends to procure masks and other PPE when they had no track record of providing this stuff. Imagine just one time the Times of London had set up a fake company, had greased the wheels with a lobbyist, got a politician to agree to give the contract. Every future procurement would be scary, because the possibility that this was a setup would exist. You wouldn't have to do it repeatedly, you'd have to do it once. And I think these areas, this healthy dose of fear, is something we need to instill in people who are at the very top of society. I think the same could be true for CEOs, by the way. The other thing that I want to talk about is how we need to seek out leaders rather than waiting for them. Many of you will know people who have a track record of leadership. Maybe it's unsung heroes of your society. Maybe it's people who have worked on a small stage, not a big one, but they've had a track record of success. And they don't want to be politicians. They don't want to be CEOs. And I can understand that, right? I mean, it's a very, very awful and ruthless game to be at the top levels of power. But we need them. We need these people. So the question is, how do we get them? Well, what's really bizarre, I used to work in politics in the US. I worked in a campaign for governor of my home state. I was the deputy campaign manager for that campaign. And what's really striking about politics is they invest a tiny proportion of money in candidate recruitment. And the reason they do this is very understandable. There's a long line of people already there. Why do you need to spend money to recruit when you've got a line of 10 people who want to be in the job? Now, those 10 people are power hungry, and they're probably not the best people for the job. And when you think about why we have elections where you vote for people where you're like, I don't want either of them, that's part of this candidate recruitment problem. So what you need to do is you need to invest in recruiting people with a track record of leadership who do not think of themselves as politicians. And on top of this, you need to ask a simple question of people who want to be in power. The question I got asked by a few people who do interviews for candidates or who work in, you know, various aspects of high-level business, what question would you ask someone who wants to be powerful? And I have a very simple answer. What do you want the power for? And what would cause you to step down after you'd achieved it? And the reason that question is so effective is because people who actually seek power, the power-hungry among us, do not see power as a means to an end. They see power as a goal. So they get completely flustered by this question. They don't know what to say. They hang on for as long as they can, right? I mean, very, very rarely do you have politicians who just say, well, I did my 4 years, that was a good time, we got what we wanted done, I'm out, right? They think about it as, how long can I stay? How long can I cling to this? I'll go kicking and screaming when the scandal finally hits. So the people who can answer that question without missing a beat, those are the people you want in charge. The people who don't want power are also the people you want in charge. They're the invisible airplanes of our society. They're the people who understand that power should be a burden. It should not be a calling. It should be difficult. It should hurt you when you make decisions, because decisions at the top levels of leadership are difficult. They cause people pain. If you're a prime minister or president of a country, you are hurting people. Now, you may be making the best decision, but you're still going to cause problems for a lot of people in your society. And if you have a properly functioning amygdala, that should keep you up at night. So when you think about it, power is not something that's supposed to be a reward. It's supposed to be a price. But it's the price that you pay for a good society. And we need people who feel like, I will take on that price for some time. I will do it because I care about my fellow citizens. I will do it because I think I can make the world just a little bit better. And I can't say it much better than the quote from one of my favorite writers, Douglas Adams, who says, "It is a well-known fact that those people who most want to rule people are those least suited to do it. Anyone who is capable of getting themselves made president should on no account be allowed to do the job." And this is true. When you think about what we actually are selecting for, we're selecting for people who want power. We're also doing things like, what skill set do you have? Can you evade a tough question? The people who evade tough questions survive. The people who answer questions honestly and show their flaws get destroyed, right? So we're selecting over and over and over for things that are not tied to leadership, but are tied to being slippery, tied to being self-serving, tied to being narcissistic, and tied to being powerful for the sake of power. And I think this is the area of our modern societies that we have to focus more attention on, is the systems. When you open the newspaper, you endlessly get disappointed, right? There's terrible news often in the news. And what you see are often a series of scandals, powerful people behaving badly. But what we do as a society that's not a smart response to this is we condemn the individual and move on. Oh, that person was corrupt. Let's replace them. Oh, that person was corrupt and abused power. Let's replace them. We think about the tip of the iceberg. We think about the planes in front of us. We think about the people who are powerful now who we can see. And the problem with that approach is that we're just going to keep on replicating this world, right? I mean, I have literally never met, and maybe there'll be somebody amongst you who will come up to me after the talk and be the first person, because we are in Denmark after all. But I've never met someone who said to me, "What's the point of your work? We get it right. I'm happy with the people on top. I'm happy with the people who are in charge. I think the system is working just fine." So even in one of the most prosperous societies in the world, like in Denmark, this is a place we can obviously do better. And I think there's a widespread sort of view that the people in charge of us are not fit for leadership. So the question is, what do we do? Condemn the individual or condemn the system? And it doesn't mean you need to say the system is all bad. It means that you need to think creatively about engineering a system, right? What we basically do instead is we inherit systems. We inherit them and we think that's how it's done. That's the way power works. You have this structure, we've done it for 50 years, and to which I say, yeah, and for 50 years you've been unhappy with the leaders. So you have to be creative about designing and engineering outcomes that are going to attract and promote the best among us. So what I'll close and leave you with is the idea, the optimistic idea, that we can do better. I'm not naive. I know this is going to be an incredibly uphill battle. Very powerful, very rich people do not want the system to change. They do not want to be ousted from power, right? They want the status quo. So it's going to be an uphill battle. And we will always have problems of self-selection. It's part of the nature of power. We will always have problems with power corrupting. It's part of the nature of power. If the ancient Greeks dealt with it, we're going to deal with some of these echoes too. But do we really think that we couldn't do better? I think that we could. And I think what I would suggest to you is, if you can, try to do a small act of leadership in your community. The ripple effects of that are really profound. I ended up interested in politics as a political scientist because my mom ran for school board when I was 8 years old. She was unhappy with the direction of the school system, and she said, "I'm not going to make any money. There's no glory in this, but I can volunteer my time effectively, and I can try to make it a little bit better." And not only did that have ripple effects for the next generation of students who went to a better school system, it had ripple effects for me because I found the sort of inspiring aspect of someone who genuinely cared working in politics. And these small aspects of change really do add up, because the pipeline of current leaders at the local level become the pipeline of leaders at the national level. I'm not an idealist who thinks we're going to solve it all. I do think we can get 30 or 40% of the problem solved, and I think that should be the task for the 21st century, so that this is the first generation where, when I ask those questions that I started with, everybody in the room raises their hand.
You were just listening to Brian Kloss on The Wrong People at the Top. Brian Kloss is professor of global politics at the University College London. He's the author of Corruptible. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ralph Nader, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, and Medea Benjamin. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Brian Kloss on the Wrong People at the Top, and for his book, Corruptible, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Science and Cocktails Foundation in Copenhagen and to Martin Folker. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Choir, 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 singing David Bowie's Heroes.